This is Jaggi Singh, and I'm reporting from Beit Sahour in occupied Palestine. I'm in the offices of the International Solidarity Movement's media office, and I'm beside Rassam Adoni, who is the director of Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People and also a founder of the International Solidarity Movement. This past weekend, Rassam presented an overview of the resistance to occupation. It was an interesting and comprehensive overview in 45 minutes. We don't have that much time, but still, we're lucky to have Rassam here to present an overview. So, Rassam, my first question to you is, you made some interesting comparisons and distinctions between the first intifada and the second intifada. In popular perception, we're currently in the midst of a second intifada. Can you tell listeners back in Montreal how you see the differences between what was happening in the late 1980s here in Palestine and what's happening now?
The first intifada was like an unexpected massive popular move against occupation, and it was based on the hope to end occupation and to arrive at a peaceful solution. The level of popular participation was very high, and it was mostly nonviolent in most of its aspects. And it delivered results, the recognition of the PLO, the start of the political talks. Now, this did not deliver much and brought us to the situation, but that came out of, you know, different factors that happened later. This intifada came about when Palestinians realized that the hope for a peaceful solution and a Palestinian state to be established near Israel is illusionary, and on ground, the occupation was moving ahead in its acts of turning Palestinian areas into closed and isolated ghettos, and therefore the fight was more seen as existential and, you know, like fighting for your last stronghold, and therefore it was more intense, more violent, more bloody in terms of how it went. At one point, the Israelis in a very brutal way wanted to dictate terms of solution that was for their, what they describe as their national interests, and dictate that on Palestinians by force. And Palestinians were trying to defend their last stronghold, because what appeared to them happening right now is either being turned into isolated ghettos or transferred from the country, and therefore people were thinking that they were fighting for their existence. And so basically one came out of hope, and the other one came out of a desperate situation. And, you know, we hope to bring back hope into this intifada and turn it back into being more massive, more popular, less violent intifada.
When you say more popular intifada, what exactly do you mean? What were specifically the things that were happening in the late 1980s that are not happening today? And be specific about how you feel that first intifada was betrayed. What happened between the 80s and now that makes people feel like they've been betrayed?
Well, when I talk about popular participation, I'm mentioning now that while all Palestinians do want to get rid of occupation, a very small percentage of Palestinians are directly active in resisting occupation. And that wasn't the case in 1987 Intifada, where people were in the midst of all of the struggle. People were disobedient, people turned back their identity cards, refused to recognize occupation as an authority, started building an authority to replace the occupation, massive demonstrations in the streets, not paying taxes or starting tax revolts, and trying to organize themselves in a way very independent to the occupation, preventing the Israeli army from entering towns. It was so massive, and that was combined, I should say, with some limited clashes and stone throwing. And basically, this is still lacking in this intifada. Occasionally in this intifada, we have seen massive protests at the beginning of this intifada. But as those massive protests were faced with Israeli brutality and shooting high-speed bullets at demonstrators and killing and injuring scores of them, it quickly turned into militant clashes and military operations and incursions, and it was like a war zone. In regard to why people feel betrayed, and you know, after the results of the first Intifada, I'm referring to the period which is called the peace process or diplomatic process period, which extended for about 10 years from Madrid conference until the end of the Camp David negotiations, or the failure of the Camp David negotiations. Basically, in this period, while there were lots of celebrations and lots of handshaking and kissings, on ground, area expropriated from Palestinians to be added to settlements were almost tripled. Number of settlers in occupied territories almost doubled. Mobility of people was shrinking all the time, and therefore people were unable to move from one area to another. The number of military checkpoints increased dramatically. The economy collapsed, and therefore on ground, people were facing different realities than what have been reported with the ceremonies and celebrations. And I think the Israeli government acted as if they were in the last 3 minutes and wanted to take over as much as they can. And really, this triggered a lot of despair and a lot of sense of betrayal. In addition to that, Palestinians who always dreamt of a Palestinian state realized that when a Palestinian authority was established, realized that this was not their dream. Those people have lots of malfunctioning, a certain level of corruption, and therefore people were disappointed both by the peace process and both by the example or model created by the Palestinian Authority, and therefore we arrived at the second Intifada, this Intifada, with lots of fears and lots of anger and lots of disappointment.
Now, people traditionally look at certain dates as touchstones in the so-called Israeli-Palestinian conflict, 1948, 1967, the first Intifada, the second Intifada. In your presentation to members of the International Solidarity Movement this past weekend, you referred back to the 1930s as a very significant moment, and many people aren't aware of that. You talked about a months-long general strike, which you refer to as one of the longest general strikes in history, period. So can you quickly and briefly tell us about the significance of that, and what lessons can we draw from what happened in the 1930s prior to the establishment of the state of Israel, and how that relates to cultivating civil resistance today?
Well, during the British Mandate period, Palestinians were faced with a double challenge. One is a colonial that's about to leave, and therefore everybody was dreaming about national independence. On the other hand, they were faced with this project to establish a Jewish state on their land, replace them, and bring others to be accommodated in their place. And therefore ran different styles of struggle, trying mostly to influence the British in order to freeze or slow down Jewish immigration to the country and try to stop or block this replacement project. One of the major landmarks was 1936 general strike, which lasted for 6 months and is recorded as being the longest general strike done by any nation all over the history. And in that, Palestinians stopped working, went into general strikes, organized lots of demonstrations, and applied a lot of pressure on the British. In fact, it was the only period in time in which the British were forced to do significant changes in their program of establishing a state. At that time, they issued laws against transfer of property from the hand of Palestinians or Arab hands of Jews or new immigrants. And in that time, there was a slowdown of the Jewish immigration, which means that this nonviolent resistance initiated by the peasant society of Palestine at that time delivered results. Not enough results to stop and block the project, but at least it was enough to slow it down and bring some substantial changes in it.
You've referred many times to nonviolent revolt, nonviolent resistance, nonviolent direct action, which forms the basis of one of the principles of the international solidarity movement. My question for you, though, is how does that kind of nonviolent civil resistance coexist with armed struggle? Do you see a role for legitimate armed struggle in a situation here where in popular perception people see armed militias, armed attacks, etc.? Where is the place for nonviolence? How does it coexist with those armed groups? And can nonviolence in and of itself end the occupation and the building of settlements?
Evidently and through history, this crisis and the Palestinian issue have been in a continued, mostly militant crisis. Palestinians fighting for their lost rights, and Israelis expanding their ability to control, manipulate, and exploit land and resources, and pushing Palestinians more steps away and placing them. Now, evidently, it's not easy to accommodate nonviolence as a strategy of resistance with a high level of violence. But to the knowledge of all of us, that all, even the significant nonviolent resistance, have been combined on their sides with violent actions from different sides, because nonviolence is a popular movement, and therefore participation is wide, and that participation allow for so many with so many different agendas to be there. Is nonviolence able to end the occupation, stop and remove settlements, or bring real justice to this area, or drive the Israeli army out of the occupied territories? I think this issue is questionable. The basic idea behind the work for nonviolence in Palestine right now and the ISM is try to challenge the tools of control that the occupier have. The formula is as simple as follows. Because Palestinians are rebellions right now, the occupation authority is expanding and intensifying its control system through a huge network of blocks and checkpoints and a high level or intolerable level of control of Palestinian lives. I think this could be challenged by nonviolent resistance, either by disobedience or by trying to remove or reverse the network of isolation and the network of control, especially roadblocks and checkpoints. And ISM and Palestinians have did many of those. Now, if we can challenge this and if we can crack it down, nonviolence can win by transferring the crisis from the side of Palestinians to the occupier side. And the need will not be for Palestinians always to adapt and assimilate to the needs of the occupier, but the occupier have to assimilate and adapt to an active nonviolent resistance that cannot tolerate this level of checkpoints and control. And I think by this we can force on the Israelis to change attitudes. If it is easy and simple for occupier to intensify control and power, they will definitely do it. When it becomes more difficult, untangible, then they are forced to think of other ways of doing it. And at that point, occupiers will realize that the only way to solve this problem is to conclude it through political negotiations that will give Palestinians their rights. This is the midterm strategy of ISM in terms of deploying violence as a strategy to win peace and justice in the Middle East.
Rassan, we're speaking together from occupied territories in Palestine, but we're also speaking in a specific town, Beit Sahur, near Jerusalem, right beside Bethlehem. And Beit Sahur is also symbolic for many reasons. And I was wondering if you could speak briefly about the meaning of this town in terms of resistance, nonviolent resistance, tax revolt, candle processions, et cetera, et cetera.
Beit Sahur, a little town of about 12,000 people nearby Bethlehem, the site of the shepherds, was well known during the first 1987 intifada, because in Beit Sahur, a movement for nonviolent resistance and civil disobedience was witnessed here and actually produced results and attracted the attention of the world. people started by throwing their identity card back to the army, and they said, we don't need your identity cards, we don't recognize you as an authority, and we are not going to abide to your military rules. And then they started their tax resistance, where they said no taxation without representation, and expressed their own willingness to only pay taxes to elected representatives of Palestinians, and massive nonviolent resistance in cooperation with Israeli peace groups were launched in the town, and even there was a resolution in the Security Council against Israel due to expropriation of goods and materials and home appliances from Beit Sahur as a punishment for not paying taxes, and that resolution was vetoed by the United States of America then and wasn't passed. Beit Sahur is really known for this, and the Center of Approachment was one of the leaders of this movement, and I think the work of ISM benefited a lot from that experience, where a community well-organized and believing in nonviolent resistance could accomplish results and could really advance the Palestinian cause towards a political solution. Unfortunately, this political solution did not materialize the way we wanted to, but I think what happened in this town was remarkable and acknowledged by many.
Okay, Rahsaan, I have one final question. Talking to other members of ISM who've been here for a long time, talking to you as well earlier, you've talked about how the ISM is being targeted specifically by the security forces here yet, that you're regarded more as a nuisance and not a threat. What is it going to take for a movement like the ISM and similar groups to move from being a nuisance to the Israelis to being an actual threat?
My assessment right now is Israelis are not looking at ISM as threatening, and therefore I don't think they can see the potential of this movement. I think for ISM to become a threat and become a significant party in resisting occupation and bringing an end to occupation, first of all, we need to see a much wider scale of Palestinian participation, campaigns that covers all the country, so regular that they can remove checkpoints and ensure that those checkpoints be removed and roads be open all over. We need to move from the dozens into the hundreds, then into the thousands and tens of thousands of people participating in those massive nonviolent direct actions. At this point, ISM will become really threatening and will become one of the major players in this crisis and this conflict. And I think at that time, it will become a threat to the occupation, and it will be one of the major significant factors that will crack down this unfair occupation to others.
Thank you, Rahsaan. It's been a late night here. This is Jaggi Singh for CKUT, and I was just talking to Rahsaan Adoni, who is a founder of the International Solidarity Movement and director of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. And we were chatting here in Beit Sahur in the occupied territories of Palestine.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to hear from Rahsaan.
No problem. And I'm hoping that you'll be hearing from other Palestinian activists here in Beit Sahur and any other town or city that I'm able to go to during my so-called illegal stay here in Palestine.